Lecture 32, Falstaff, Act 2, Conclusion, Act 3.
We return to the life and operas of Verdi. This is our final lecture, Lecture 32, and it is entitled Falstaff, Act 2, Conclusion, and Act 3. The brave warrior hunters have just mustered their courage, charged the screen behind which they believe Falstaff and Alice are hiding, overturned it, and instead of finding Falstaff and Alice, they have found instead, to their great surprise, Anne and Fenton, joined as they are at the sternum, groin, and lips. Dr. Caius cries, "It's not him!" Well, no beep, Sherlock. Anne and Fenton are mortified. Everyone gasps, and from the back of the room, Alice, Meg, and Mrs. Quickly together sing, "Not good," while everyone else sings, "Amazing!" Anne, Fenton, and Dr. Caius, who believes himself to be Anne's future husband, scream in terror, "Arrgh!" Ford is furious. He barks at his daughter, "You still refuse to obey me?" And now Ford shrieks at Fenton, "Get away from her and get on with your life! I've told you 1,000 times, my daughter is not for you!" Anne runs from the room weeping as Fenton sullenly creeps away. Suddenly, blaring, hunting horn-like brass fanfares accompany an alarm sounded by Bardolph, who runs toward the back corner of the room and shouts, "There he is! Stop him!" Ford asks, "Where?" And Pistol answers, "There, on the stairs!" To which Ford charitably cries, "Quarter him!" And everyone yells, "To the hunt!" All the men run to the stairwell at the rear of the stage and exit, hooting and shouting like baying dogs on a fox's trail. What a bunch of idiots. One wonders what Bardolph and Pistol thought they saw anyway. Given his rotundity, Sir John Falstaff is not an easy object to mistake. Did they see a shadow? Bigfoot? Perhaps Elvis in his bloated Las Vegas incarnation? Who knows? What we do know is that Falstaff, hot, sweaty, and probably beginning to cramp up, is still in the hamper on stage, Mrs. Quickly remarks as the men exit. What an infernal hunt! And indeed it is. Alice decides that it's time to end this craziness once and for all. She rings her bell and calls for the servants. Ned, Will, Tom, Isaac! The four manservants enter along with Anne, who has recovered from her weeping fit, and a page. Alice tells them, "Empty that basket out the window and into the water in the ditch. Right, there, there, yes, in front of that group of washerwomen." Anne, Meg, and Mrs. Quickly together register their approval. "See, see, 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 yes, 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 yes." To the servants, who are straining mightily to pick up the hamper, Anne sings, "C'è dentro un pezzo grosso." There's a very heavy piece of something in there. Now, here Boito has indulged in a pun in that last line, as the phrase un pezzo grosso, aside from meaning a very heavy piece of something, is also Italian slang for an important person, what we might refer to as a heavyweight or a heavy hitter. Meanwhile, Alice quickly turns to the page and tells him, "You, go get my husband and bring him here." Alice explains her plan to Meg. "We'll explain to him our entire ridiculous situation. When he sees the great knight in the ditch, I do believe he will be cured of his jealousy." Meanwhile, Mrs. Quickly and Anne are monitoring the progress of the servants, who have just managed to get the hamper up off the ground. Ponderous, almost staggering orchestral music would indicate that something really heavy is in the hamper. And Mrs. Quickly says to the men, "It's heavy." Oh, like they needed to be told, right? Both Anne and Meg encourage the staggering men, crying, "Coraggio, coraggio, courage." A cracking noise is heard, and Anne sounds a warning, "I think the bottom is about to give way." The women shout as the hamper approaches the open window. "Higher, higher." Mission control, We have liftoff. We've cleared the gantry. Yes, the hamper reaches the edge of the window. The music quiets to near nothing as the hamper tips outward, and the women shout with joy, "Triumphu! Triumph! Ha ha!" The hamper disappears out the window, and the women rush over and look out. One after the other, Alice, Anne, and Meg exclaim, "What a splash!" At that moment, Ford and the other men re-enter the room. Alice takes her husband by the arm and leads him over to the window. Everyone follows, and everyone looks out and down. We can only imagine what they see. A sopping wet Sir John sitting in the mud, his hair dripping wet, perhaps a small fish flopping on his head, a dazed expression on his face. Immenso laughter from everybody, and everybody sings Patatrac, the Italian equivalent to kaboom. Curtain and end of Act Two. Let us listen to the conclusion of the act from Dr. Caius's stunned, "Non è lui! It's not him!" through to its riotous conclusion.
Squarta!
Opening of Act Three sees Falstaff back at the Inn of the Garter, there to lick the gaping, bleeding wounds to his pride. Dejected, he sings, "Thieving world, rotten world, evil world, I have lived a long time. I'm a bold and skillful knight, and yet to be carried in a basket and thrown into a slimy ditch with the dirty clothes. Why, if my puffed-up belly hadn't floated for me, I would have drowned for sure. Ugly death! Evil world! There's no virtue anymore. Everything's going downhill. Va, vecchio John. Go, old John. Go, go on your way. Walk on until you die. Then, yes, then, at that moment, true virility will disappear entirely from the world. That will be a dark, dark day." But, you know, when push comes to shove, you can't keep a good man down, and Falstaff ultimately is a good man whose life spirit is as big as his body. And it's a good thing that he rapidly recovers his joie de vivre, because the women are not through with him yet. Mrs. Quickly shows up at the Garter Inn yet again, and claims that Falstaff's dunking was perpetrated by wicked, wicked servants, and that the beautiful Alice is even now weeping with grief and frustration. Of course, Falstaff falls for it again. It is his nature to be a stooge for women, and at heart, he is an eternal optimist. Falstaff is told to come to the royal park at witching hour, midnight, disguised as the Black Huntsman. Falstaff does what he is told, and it is there, in the park, that Falstaff is once again made to look the fool, scared to death as he is by children disguised as sprites and fairies. Ultimately, while he is lying on the ground, quivering with fear, he is assailed by everyone who gather around him and, one after the other, call him pretty much every name in the book. Lout, poltroon, glutton, big belly, drunkard, rogue, billy goat, parasite, braggart, puffed up paunch, swollen cheek, bed smasher, doublet splitter, barrel emptier, chair breaker, horse destroyer, globe of impurity, triplice mento, triple chin. Oh, that last one's got to hurt. When it is finally revealed to Falstaff that Master Fountain is really Master Ford, and he has had a moment to ponder the degree to which he's been made a fool, Falstaff utters those memorable and frankly wonderful words. I'm beginning to realize that I behaved like an ass. A sentiment with which everyone gathered around him there in the Royal Park can agree. It is here, nearing the conclusion of the opera, that Falstaff makes the observation that forever raises him above the level of a knave and a clown and turns him into a person that, if not heroic, is at least in his own way virtuous and dignified. He looks at those around him, and with great dignity and humor, he sings, "Every sort of common person taunts me and insults me and boasts about it. And yet, despite all their vanity and conceit, without me, they'd have little interest in their lives. It is I who makes you clever. It is my cleverness that creates cleverness in others." Verdi sets Falstaff's monologue here in a very free, half-lyric, half-declamatory manner. It is filled with wonderful little inflections to which the orchestra supplies the barest of punctuation. Let's hear it, starting with "Ogni sorta di gente dozzinale," every sort of common person.
Ogni sorta di gente dozzinale mi beffa. Esse ne gloria, pur senza me, costor con tanta voglia, non avrebbero un briciolo di sale. Sor io, che li fa scaltri. L'arguzia mia, crea l'arguzia degli altri.
Falstaff's words are both dignified and true, as the assembled crowd gladly acknowledges. Everyone sings, "Ma bravo," why, good for you. Still being Mr. Tough Guy, Ford now sings to Falstaff, "By the gods, if I weren't laughing so much, I'd stomp on you. But enough. Everyone listen. We'll crown this beautiful masquerade with the wedding of the Queen of the Fairies." Now, it is now time for Master Ford to take his fall. Earlier in the third act, Ford made the unilateral decision that his daughter Anne would indeed marry Dr. Caius this very night. He gave instructions when the disguises for the evening were handed out that Anne be dressed as the Queen of the Fairies. Of course, virtually no one else wants to see Anne marry the old and irksome Dr. Caius. They want to see Anne married to that nice Fenton. He's such a polite young man. So unbeknownst to either Ford or Dr. Caius, it is Bardolph who's dressed as the Queen of the Fairies, with his face and massive, protuberant nose hidden behind a long veil. It is the beveiled Bardolph dressed as the Queen of the Fairies that now comes forward hand in hand with Dr. Caius. The orchestra strikes up a gentle, rustic-sounding three-step, and Ford proudly exclaims, "The procession has already begun. Attention!" Falstaff and the chorus sing, "Everybody, attention!" Looking lovingly at the rather large lump dressed in white that he believes to be his daughter, Ford sings, "Here she is, dressed in white, with rosy cheeks and the garland of the Virgin. Surround her, O nymphs!" Dr. Caius and Bardolph, again, Bardolph is disguised as the Queen of the Fairies, stand at center stage. The children, dressed as fairies and sprites, surround them. Alice walks over to Master Ford and presents to him two more people who have just come on stage. One of them is a woman, covered completely by a huge blue veil. The other is a man wearing a mask and a cloak. Of course, they are Anne and Fenton. Alice knows who they are. The audience knows who they are, but Mr. Ford and Dr. Caius, of course, do not know who they are. Alice says to her husband, "Another couple of anxious lovers asks to join this propitious marriage ceremony." Ford doesn't care one way or the other. He sings, "Fine, we'll make it a double wedding. Bring the lanterns closer. May heaven unite you all." And thus the ceremony ends. The couples are united. Ford sings, "Off now with the masks and the veils. Apotheosis." And so the masks and veils are removed. And an apotheosis it is. Everyone, with the notable exceptions of Dr. Caius and Master Ford, laughs uproariously. "Hardy, har, 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 har." Dr. Caius looks as if he's just found maggots in his toothpaste. He thought he just married a young and curvaceous virgin, and instead he's staring at Bardolph. All he can do is croak, "Spavento! Horror!" Ford can't believe his eyes either. He cries, "Tradimento! I'm betrayed!" Falstaff, Pistol, and the chorus think this is a lovely turn of events. They mock Ford by singing, "Apotheosis! Yuck, 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 yuck." And for Ford, the worst is yet to come. He now looks at the other couple and realizes that they are Fenton and my daughter! "You got that right, babe. And by the power vested in you, you just married them." Dr. Caius croaks again, "I married Bardolph!" The crowd loves it. They sing, "Snick, snick, 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 snick." Dr. Caius continues to twitch, singing convulsively, "Spavento, spavento. Oh, the horror of it all." And the crowd just loves it. They sing, "Vittoria, evviva, evviva, victory, hurrah, hurrah." Ford still can't believe what has just happened. He sings, "Holy cow." And Alice turns to her husband and sings, "A man is often hoisted by his own petard." Falstaff approaches Ford, bows, and with the tables thus turned, asks, "Dear good Master Ford, who now has been made to look the fool?" Ford points, of course, at Dr. Caius and sings, "Him!" Dr. Caius points back at Ford and sings, "You!" Ford protesteth, "No!" Dr. Caius insists, "Yes, yes, yes, yes! You, 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 you!" And now a voice of wisdom intercedes as Bardolph says to both Ford and Dr. Caius, "Both of you have been made to look the fool." Fenton agrees and sings, "Both of them." And Dr. Caius, in a rare moment of humility, sings, "Okay, both of us." Falstaff puts an exclamation on the discussion, singing, "Tutti e due, both." Alice, however, has the last word. Putting Falstaff together with Dr. Caius and Ford, she sings, "No, tutti e tre, all three of you." Pointing now to Anne and Fenton, Alice sings directly to her husband, "Take a look at these wonderful kids. They're so in love." Anne sings to her father, "Oh, forgive us, father." Ford, touched to his very soul, sings, "The father who cannot control his own children must accept their wishes." Let's listen, starting with the assembled crowd singing, "Ma bravo!" Why, good for you, in response to Falstaff's monologue, and moving through the wedding scene and Ford's heartfelt lament that the father who cannot control his own children must accept their wishes.
Ma bravo! Ma basta! Ed or voi che l'ascoltiate, coronerem la mascherata bella con gli sponsali della regina delle fate. già s'avanza la coppia degli sposi. Attenti,
attenti.
Eccola, in bianca vesta, col velo e il serto delle rose in testa, e il fidanzato suo, Chiore di sposi, circondatelo ninfe.
Un'altra coppia d'amanti desirosi, chiede d'essere ammessa agli amorosi connubi.
E sia, farei la festa doppia. Avvicinate i lumi. Il ciel bacco. Le maschere, i veli, apoteosi. Momento, tradimento. Fenton con mia figlia ha sposato Bardolfo. Oh, meraviglia.
Monta di spesso nelle reti ardite, donne malizie sole.
Come può messer Ford ed ora dite
lo scornato?
Chi è?
Lui,
tu,
no,
sì, voi,
no,
noi,
tutti e due.
Master Ford, faced as he is with the done deal of his daughter's marriage to Fenton, decides quite rightly that it's time to go into flow. If you can't beat him, join him. Suddenly, with great warmth and conviction, he declares, "Let us be a family, and may heaven bless you and give you joy." Fine and true words, my friends. Everyone on stage sings, "Eviva!" Right on! Falstaff wants to have the last word. He sings, "One last chorus, and we'll end this scene." Ford gives Falstaff his blessing to proceed, after which Sir John Falstaff will all go to dinner. Once again, everybody sings, "Eviva! Free food!" First Falstaff, and then everybody sings, "Everything in the world is a jest. Man is born to be made a fool of. In his mind, reason is always wavering. Everything is a joke. We make each other crazy, all of us. But he who laughs well, has the last laugh." This fantastic closing ensemble, composed as a fugue, was one of the very first parts of Falstaff that Verdi actually composed. On August 18th of 1889, just 1 month after having received the outline of the libretto, Verdi wrote Boito, and we quote, "I hope you are working on the libretto. More strange still is that I too am working. I am having a great time writing fugues. Yes, sir, a fugue and a buffa fugue, a comic fugue, one that will go very nicely in Falstaff." "What? A buffa fugue, you will say? I do not know how or why, but it is a buffa, a comic fugue," unquote. The thematic materials out of which the fugue is constructed first appeared earlier in the opera during Act I. Knowing what we know about the chronology of the fugue, that it was among the very first parts of Falstaff to be composed, it would be more appropriate to say that Verdi appropriated various thematic elements of the fugue and used them in earlier parts of the opera, seeding the opera, as he did, with material that would achieve its own apotheosis in the final moments of the opera. Let us listen then to the closing minutes of Falstaff, from Mr. Ford's Wedding Blessing to Anne and Fenton. Facciamo il parentado, let us be a family, and may heaven bless you and give you joy through the brilliant, chattering, and in all ways buffa fugue and the opera's brilliant conclusion.
Facciamo il parentado e che il ciel vi dia gioia. Un coro e termini alla cena. Voi con Ser Falstaff tutti andiamo a cena. Tutto del mondo è burlo l'uomo. E tanto burlone, burlone, burlone.
Tutto del mondo burlo
l'uomo. Come nato burlone. E nato burlone, burlone, burlone.
Tutto del mondo burlo l'uomo. Come nato
burlone. E nato burlone, burlone, burlone.
Tutto del mondo è burlo l'uomo.
E nato burlone, burlone, burlone. Nessuno c'è il mondo.
Tutto
lo c'è.
Verdi's last great work. In 1900, the 87-year-old Verdi was asked by a friend which of his creations was his favorite. Verdi's response was extraordinary, and it tells us much about the man and where his priorities lay near the end of his life. His response, we quote Verdi, "Of all my works, the one that is dearest to me is the home I built in Milan for old artists who were not favored by fortune and not endowed with the virtue of thrift. Poor, dear companions of my life, believe me, this home is really my most beautiful work, my most beautiful opera," unquote. Verdi was referring to the Casa di Riposo per Musicisti, the House of Rest for Musicians, that he endowed and had built on the Piazza Michelangelo Buonarroti in Milan. Immediately after the premiere of Falstaff, Verdi got down to serious business on the Casa di Riposo. In 1895, he approved the plans and put 550,000 gold lira into a special account for the casa's construction. Construction was complete in 1899, and the Casa Riposa, or the Casa Verde, as the Milanese call it, officially opened its doors in 1902, the year after Verdi died. Originally two stories in height, a third story was added in 1937. Since it opened in 1902, there has never been an empty room in the Casa di Riposa. From the moment its doors opened to the present day, there has been a waiting list to get in. According to Verdi's instructions, the residents were and are, quote, Italian citizens who have reached the age of 65, have practiced the art of music professionally, and find themselves in a state of poverty, unquote. Literally thousands of men and women have spent their last years at the Casa di Riposa without ever having to worry about money. Today, there are 100 rooms at the Casa, which are occupied by 60 men and 40 women, the exact ratio of men to women that Verdi stipulated in his bequest. Verdi also set up the order of preference according to which musicians would be admitted to the Casa. It is an ordering that tells us lots about Verdi's own priorities regarding the relative importance of musicians. First to be admitted to the Casa, according to Verdi, are composers. Next, singers. Then conductors, chorus masters, and lastly, orchestra players. In his will, Verdi bequeathed a portion of his royalties to the Casa for perpetuity. Although today, inflation and expenses being what they are, the Casa di Riposa is supported by both the city of Milan and the state of Italy. Nevertheless, Verdi's presence is still felt at every turn at the Casa. For example, one of the house rules is that all male retirees must wear the so-called Verdi hats, the wide-brimmed black felt hats with crushed crowns that Verdi wears in so many of his photographs and portraits, a style of hat worn by the peasants of Verdi's native Parma. A gratuitous but nevertheless relevant comparison. Richard Wagner built a shrine, a temple to himself at Bayreuth, using other people's money to which the masses could come and pay homage to his genius. Verdi spent a goodly portion of his last years and his own money, his own life savings, building a home for what he called his poor, dear companions. We say no more. Last years. Verdi's love of hard work, his need for action, precluded any sort of genuine retirement. There was the design and construction of the Casa di Riposa, new editions and translations of his operas to work on and approve, performances to oversee, his grandchildren to dote on, the children of his adopted daughter, Filomena Maria, an endless stream of well-wishers, fans, and autograph hunters to fight off, and the ever-present needs of his estates and the big house at Santa Agata. Following the premiere of Falstaff, Verdi returned to Santa Agata, from where he wrote the conductor Eduardo Mascheroni, and we quote, I am at Santa Agata, and I can draw a deep breath. But what am I saying? I have so much to do here, too. It is fate. Every man has a destiny, one to stay on his mother's breast all his life, one to be a cuckold, one to be rich, one to be poor. I, with my tongue hanging out like a mad dog, to work all the time until the last blow falls, unquote. Those last blows began to fall in late 1897. At 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, November 14th, Giuseppina Stripponi Verdi, aged 82, died. She had been unwell for months, and pneumonia carried her off. Verdi stayed by her side throughout her final illness. Immediately following her death, he was described as, quote, silent, erect, unable to speak, unquote. In her will, Giuseppina left instructions for her funeral, indicating that it was to be conducted at dawn without flowers or speeches of any sort, writing, and we quote Giuseppina's will, I came into the world poor and without pomp, and I want to leave it the same way, unquote. Giuseppina was buried in Milan's Cimitero Monumentale. Arrigo Boito was at Verdi's side, as was the Ricordi family, Arturo Toscanini, and dignitaries from the Italian and municipal governments. Giuseppina remained generous, monetarily and spiritually, to the last. In her will, she left monies to be given every year to the 50 poorest families of St. Agata. She left 12,000 lira to the hospital of Villanova. She left large sums of money and pensions to her family. And to Teresa Stoltz, she left a collection of fine jewelry, including a diamond-encrusted watch. The last words of her will asked God's protection for Verdi, and that, quote, God reunite him with me for all eternity in a better world. And now, addio, my Verdi. As we were united in life, may God rejoin our spirits in heaven, unquote. After Giuseppina's death, Verdi was never alone. The Villa Verdi at St. Agata constantly buzzed with activity. Arrigo Boito, Teresa Stoltz, and the Ricordi family all stayed with Verdi as he gradually regained his equilibrium following Giuseppina's death. Verdi's adopted daughter, Filomena Maria, and her children were a constant presence, as was her husband and his family, the Carreras. Oh my goodness, it's been a long time since we talked about Filomena Maria. Born in November of 1859 and adopted by the Verdis in 1868, she attended a prestigious boarding school in Turin and graduated in August of 1877, a few months shy of her 18th birthday. At the time she finished school, she was already engaged to Alberto Carrara, the grandson of Verdi's friend, lawyer, and early biographer, Giuseppe Di Maldè. Their marriage took place on October 11th of 1878 at the Villa Verdi. Verdi was thrilled that Filomena Maria had married a local, a fellow Parmesan, a man of his own country, whom Verdi considered serious and honest. Filomena Maria Verdi walked to the altar on Giuseppe Verdi's arm. Within a few months of Giuseppina's death, the 84-year-old Verdi was very much back to his old self, taking care of farm business, overseeing the construction of the Casa di Riposa, yelling at the domestic help, surrounded by his friends and family, and playing cards until midnight. Verdi, who for so long had fled from such company, now absolutely loved it. For example, in November of 1899, the 86-year-old Verdi received a letter from Giulio and Giudetta Ricordi asking if they could come to visit. They would be joining other guests already in residence, including their son Tito Ricordi and his wife, as well as Boito. Thrilled, Verdi immediately wrote back, quote, "Oh, joy of all joys! We will be a veritable brigade! My carriage will be waiting for you at the station," unquote. For a man of his age, Verdi's health and quickness of mind remained remarkably good. He was, according to his doctors, their proudest specimen. His one concession to age was the massages that he received twice a day, which were the envy of his houseguests. In a letter to Giulio Ricordi, dated March 2, 1900, Verdi wrote that he had little to complain about, although he felt obligated to complain, and we quote, "Because I have been complaining all my life, as long as I've been in the world. It is one of my greatest talents," unquote. Death. For Verdi, the end came on January 21st, 1901, in his room at Milan's Grand Hotel. He was sitting on the edge of his bed, buttoning his vest, when he began to shake. The maid who was in the room with him asked him if he was all right. Verdi said, "One button more or one button less," and passed out. It was a massive stroke from which he never regained consciousness. Verdi lingered for 6 days, long enough for his friends and family to gather and long enough for the Italian nation to gird itself for the loss of its greatest and most beloved citizen. During his last illness, the hotel was closed to all incoming guests. Traffic outside the hotel was rerouted, and tram conductors were forbidden to ring their bells anywhere near the hotel. The entire nation kept vigil, with bulletins being issued from a press room installed on the ground floor. A despairing Arrigo Boito hardly left Verdi's side. He later described that last week to Verdi biographer Camille Balegue. We quote Boito, "He died magnificently, like a formidable silent fighter. 1 week before he died, the silence of death fell on him. Do you know the admirable bust of the maestro by Gemito? This bust, sculpted 40 years ago, is the exact image of the maestro as he was on the fourth day before the end. His head bowed down on his chest and his eyebrows drawn together, he seemed to be calculating in his mind the strength needed to fight an adversary. He mounted a heroic resistance. Poor Maestro! How courageous and handsome he was, right up to the last moment! I have never experienced such a feeling of hatred for death, of contempt for that mysterious, blind, stupid, triumphant, and craven power. Unquote. Surrounded at the end by Boito, Teresa Stoltz, Filomena Maria, and her daughter, Pepina, his son-in-law, Alberto Carrera, and Giulio and Giudetta Ricordi, Verdi died at 2:50 a.m. on January 27, 1901. Word traveled quickly, and within minutes, even at that early hour in the cold of winter, a quiet and respectful crowd began to gather outside the hotel. By dawn that day, the flags of the city and churches had been draped with black ribbons of mourning. For the next 3 days, the shops and theaters of Milan were closed, and newspapers across Italy came out with black borders around their edges. Within hours of Verdi's death, speeches were being given to his honor in Parliament. Of all the many such expressions of grief and gratitude, I offer a bit of a speech made by the Minister of Internal Affairs of the nation of Italy, Antonio Focazzaro, who spoke well for his nation when he declared that Verdi, quote, deserved more than anyone to be the symbol of the heroic era of our Risorgimento because of the mystic fusion of his music and the longed-for, prayed-for unity of our nation. Verdi was our great unifier when the wave of his passionate music, something that the enemy could not seize, embodied the idea of the nation, which swept freely from the Alps to the sea, setting our hearts on fire. We could turn to him in pride. Because of him, we felt that we were all Italians. Unquote. As per his request, Verdi's actual funeral on January 30th, 1901, was a modest one. But an estimated 200,000 people silently lined the streets of Milan as the hearse bearing Verdi's body first made its way to the Church of San Francisco di Paola and then to the Cimitero Monumentale, where he was buried beside Giuseppina. 4 weeks later, on February 27th, Verdi and Giuseppina's bodies were moved to the crypt of the Casa di Riposo, where they lie to this day. A plaque on the wall of their tomb honors the memory of Margherita Barezzi, and the walls are decorated with mosaics commissioned by Teresa Stoltz from Venice's Murano Glass Company. At the time of Verdi's death, Stoltz herself was ill as well. She had cancer, and La Stoltz followed Verdi to the grave 1 year later, aged 67 years. Verdi died a very wealthy man. His estate was estimated to be worth 6 million lira, or, as calculated in 1990 values, about 30 billion lira, or $24 million. At the time of his death, Verdi's estimated annual income from his farms, investments, and royalties was roughly the equivalent of $1 million a year in terms of 1990 dollars. And while we do not have the time to discuss Verdi's will in any detail, suffice it to say that directly or indirectly, he provided for almost every person and every educational and medical institution in the Duchy of Parma. Verdi's philanthropy remains unmatched by any other artist with whom I am familiar. The great Verdi scholar Julian Budden writes, quote, starting with a technique cruder and more primitive than that of any young composer of comparable stature, the provincial from Busetto achieved a refinement of musical craftsmanship and thought that has never been surpassed and rarely equaled. The upwards path can be traced from opera to opera, but no amount of foresight could have deduced the end, Falstaff, from the beginning. That the commonplaces of the 1840s should have been fanned into such magnificent life 45 years later is a miracle of regeneration without parallel in the history of music. Unquote. Our parting story. In 1918, 25 years after the premiere of Falstaff, the great conductor Arturo Toscanini was examining Verdi's handwritten score of Falstaff at the House of Ricordi there in Milan. Inside the score, Toscanini found a note that Verdi had handwritten on his personal stationery, a note that Verdi had inserted into the score after he had finished it, and that had gone undiscovered until that moment. Across the top, Verdi had written, "Le ultime note del Falstaff," the last notes of Falstaff, followed by these words in his own hand, which stand as Verdi's perfect eulogy to himself. And we quote, "Tutto è finito." Everything is finished. "Va, vecchio John. Go on, old John. Go on down your road as far as you can. You're a rascal, entertaining, yes, but always honest beneath your various masks. Honest all the time, in every place. Go. Be off with you. Be off with you. Addio." Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.